good morning to everybody. This is the fourth time that I've had the privilege of participating in this forum, having spoken in 2010, 2011, 2012, and now 2013. Now, over this period, the Australian economy has undergone very significant change. My central message today is that overall this change, this adjustment, has proceeded pretty well, particularly in light of the extraordinary developments that have occurred in the global economy over these years. And this message is not meant to downplay the disruptive and sometimes painful effects of the changes that are taking place. At the Reserve Bank, we've spent a lot of time trying to understand the stresses and the strains facing parts of the economy as a result of structural change. But we've also spent a lot of time trying to understand the benefits that come from this change, including an increase in our average living standards and in higher productivity. From an overall perspective, it's important that we do not lose sight of what we've been able to achieve here in Australia. We've managed a fair degree of internal balance during a period in which there's been very large structural change, a very large shift in world relative prices, a major boom in investment, and a financial crisis in many of the North Atlantic economies. Our economic performance has been much better than many other countries, and we remain very well placed to benefit from the shift of economic weight towards the emerging market economies, particularly those in Asia. While I understand that many companies face challenges, we should not lose sight of this bigger picture. It's a bigger picture that I suspect many other countries in the world wish they shared. Now, I'd like to begin this morning by briefly summarising the broad economic outcomes in Australia since I first spoke at this forum in March 2010. Since that time, output in the Australian economy has increased by 9%. The number of people with jobs has risen by over 500,000. The unemployment rate today at 5.4% is exactly the same as it was in March 2010. And the underlying inflation rate has averaged 2.5% over these years, exactly the midpoint of the inflation target. So over these 3 years, we've seen growth close to trend, a stable and relatively low unemployment rate, and inflation at target. By the standards of most other countries, this would represent very good outcomes and a high degree of internal balance. Remarkably, we've been able to achieve this balance despite experiencing the biggest boom in business investment and the largest rise in the terms of trade for over 100 years. And you can see these increases in this chart, which shows data for more than 100 years. Now, in the past, much smaller booms in investment and the terms of trade caused outbreaks of inflation and the emergence of other imbalances in the economy. And on this occasion, this has not happened. The investment boom has not led to a large increase in the current account deficit. There's not been an explosion of credit. Increases in asset prices have generally been contained. And the average level of interest rates has been below the long-term average, despite the very significant increases in demand generated by the record levels of investment and the record terms of trade. Now, there are a number of factors that are important in understanding how this domestic balance has been maintained with generally low interest rates, despite these very large shocks experienced by the Australian economy. And this morning, I want to focus on just two of these. The first is the flexible exchange rate. The high levels of investment and commodity prices, as you all know, have been associated with a high value of the Australian dollar. And this has clearly caused some difficulties for parts of our economy, including manufacturing, parts of the tourism industry, and the education sectors. But from an overall macroeconomic perspective, the appreciation of the exchange rate has played an important stabilising role. Had we not experienced this sizable appreciation, It's highly likely that the economy would have overheated and that we would have had substantially higher inflation and substantially higher interest rates. This would not have been in the interests of the community at large, nor, I might add, of the sectors currently being adversely affected by the high exchange rate. I think it's worth adding that in any case, it's unlikely that we could have avoided a substantial real exchange rate appreciation, but it would have come through the more costly route of higher inflation. Now, this, of course, does not mean that at each and every point in time, the exchange rate isn't an ideal rate from a domestic balance perspective. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that exchange rates are relative prices between two countries' monies. This means that they're determined by what's happening domestically and by what's happening abroad. And this has been very obvious over recent years, with the very accommodative monetary conditions in many of the advanced economies tending to put downward pressure on the value of their currencies, including relative to the Australian dollar. As we've said a number of times, the Reserve Bank has responded to this development by lowering the cash rate. It's also worth repeating that this lowering of the cash rate has not been with the direct intention of achieving a lower exchange rate, but rather with the intention of offsetting some of the contractionary effects on the Australian economy of the high value of the Australian dollar. Over recent times, our extensive discussions with Australian business confirm that they are adjusting to the high value of the currency. When I spoke at this forum in March 2010 and then again in March 2011, my sense was that many businesses were hoping that the high exchange rate was just a temporary development, that it would pass and that business models wouldn't have to change that much. Today, I have quite a different sense. Nowadays, there's a greater recognition that the high exchange rate is likely to be quite persistent, and firms, including in the manufacturing sector, are adjusting to this. Many are looking to improve their internal processes and to address inefficiencies. They're focusing on products where value added is highest and where the quality of the workforce is a strategic advantage. And we hear from business right across the country that they are looking for improvements, and many are finding them. Now, this adjustment in business processes and models is often painful. But the fact that it is occurring is one reason why the Reserve Bank has been tentatively optimistic for some time that productivity growth would pick up from the low rates we've seen over much of the previous decade. And we're now seeing some tentative signs of this pickup in the aggregate data, which I hope you can see here. While the productivity data tend to be volatile from year to year and subject to sizable revisions, aggregate productivity growth in 2012 was better than it has been for some time. Of course, we can't be sure that this will continue, but the structural changes that are now occurring mean that there are reasonable prospects for a sustained lift in productivity growth in the coming years. We can also see evidence of the adjustment in the detailed industry data, including in the manufacturing sector. While there's been little net growth of aggregate output or aggregate exports from manufacturing for some years, some parts of the industry have done quite well. I hope you can see this from this next chart. Output of machinery and equipment and of metals have both trended higher over recent years, and exports of specialised mining equipment and other types of machinery have also increased, as have exports in some other categories. Many of these are areas where Australia does have a comparative advantage and where value added is high. And it's by focusing on these comparative advantages that we can best build a strong and a successful manufacturing sector while at the same time living with the high exchange rate. I'd now like to turn to the second broad factor that has helped maintain domestic balance during this once-in-a-century investment boom, and that's the increase in household saving. Since the mid-2000s, the household sector net saving rate has risen from around zero to around 10%. You can see this in this chart. In today's money, this represents an additional $90 billion that is saved, not spent, by households each year. Now, I know that this increase in household saving has not been universally welcomed in the retail industry. It's caused difficulties for some businesses, including those who'd base their business decisions on a continuation of the earlier trends. But again, consider how the economy might have looked over the past few years had households spent an extra $90 billion each year. It's likely that there would have been significant overheating. The exchange rate would have had to have been higher. There would have been more borrowing from the rest of the world. Inflation and interest rates would have been higher. I suggest these are not developments that would have been warmly welcomed by most in the community. So somewhat ironically, two of the factors that have created difficult challenges for many businesses over recent years, that's the high exchange rate and the increased household savings, are the very same factors that have been critical to Australia's good macroeconomic performance. Importantly, these factors have helped Australia digest a huge investment boom without generating substantial imbalances in the economy. At the same time, these factors have promoted significant structural change, which, while difficult to manage, is critical to achieving overall higher productivity growth and higher living standards. So there's clearly a lot of change going on in the Australian economy at the moment, and how you view that change depends critically upon where you stand. However, no matter what one's perspective, we should not lose sight of the fact that maintaining overall macro balance throughout this period of change has been a very significant achievement, and it's an achievement that has benefited the entire community. So far, I've discussed structural factors, but monetary policy has also played some role in helping maintain this overall internal balance. In particular, Australia's credible medium-term inflation targeting framework has served us very well through this period of change. I want to point out, though, that monetary policy cannot make the various global factors driving our economy go away. Monetary policy cannot, nor should it attempt to, prevent structural change from occurring. What we can do is deal as best we can with the hand that the global economy has dealt us. We can help ensure that aggregate demand and supply remain in broad balance so that when firms are making employment, investment and production decisions, they can do so with reasonable confidence about the health of the overall economy. We can also ensure that inflation remains low and stable so that uncertainty about the overall level of prices is not added to the list of things that the community has to worry about. Now, since November 2011, the Board of the Reserve Bank has lowered the cash rate 6 times. It's a cumulative 1.75 percentage points. These reductions have brought the cash rate down to 3%, which is equal to its lowest level on record. Lending rates have also come down substantially, although a number are still above their earlier lows, given the general rise in bank funding costs that has occurred since the global financial crisis. Now, recently, there's been quite a lot of discussion as to whether these lower rates are actually working. This type of discussion is not surprising, given there are lags between monetary policy is changed and when the full effect is felt on the economy. It's not a matter of simply changing interest rates today and seeing an immediate effect tomorrow. Another complication is that the environment in which interest rates are being adjusted is not the same from one interest rate cycle to another. And as a result, the exact way that movements in interest rates are transmitted to the economy changes over time. All this means, as always, we need to monitor things very closely. At the moment, though, the available evidence does suggest that lower interest rates are doing their work broadly as expected. In general, the initial responses to a loosening of monetary policy would be expected to include stronger asset prices, improved conditions in the housing market, a lift in consumer confidence, and a lower exchange rate. Much of this does seem to be occurring. Nationwide measures of house prices have increased by around 4% since mid-last year, after they declined for the previous 18 months. Home lending approvals and auction clearance rates have both risen. Equity prices are up 20% since the middle of last year. And the level of consumer confidence is now well above its long-run average level, as demonstrated in this chart. Despite what one often hears, households do appear to be feeling better about their finances, as well as Australia's medium-term prospects. Now, the one notable exception to the expected responses following a substantial easing of monetary policy is that there's been little movement in the exchange rate. However, this reflects the global factors that I mentioned earlier, and the Reserve Bank has attempted to calibrate the setting of monetary policy to take account of this. Now, if the monetary transmission mechanism is working broadly as it has in the past, then the improvement in consumer sentiment and higher asset prices should feed through in time to higher spending by households. And there are some signs, although this is still tentative, that this is beginning to occur. The latest ABS data in the bank's extensive liaison suggests slightly firmer retail spending over recent months than was the case over the second part of last year, although conditions clearly remain mixed across the industry. There are also signs of a pickup in the forward indicators for new dwelling construction, and Harley talked about these. There's also a gradual improvement in a number of the labour market indicators, which had softened substantially last year. Now, another critical element in the monetary transmission process is a pickup in private business investment. This happens to often be the last link in the chain, and it typically follows higher confidence and increased household spending. Given the nature of the investment boom we're currently experiencing, it's non-mining investment where we're looking for the pickup to occur this time. And as mining investment inevitably peaks and then gradually declines, a critical question for the outlook is the strength of this expected pickup in non-mining investment. We can't yet know the answer to this question, but what we do know is that other parts of the transmission mechanism appear to be working broadly in line with our expectations, and that there are tentative signs of a lift in investment intentions outside the resources sector. The most noteworthy of these was the capital expenditure data published by the ABS a few weeks ago, which show that firms expected to increase spending on non-mining construction and on machinery and equipment investment in the next financial year. Whether the increases will be sufficient to offset the expected lower levels of mining investment is an issue that we'll be obviously watching very, very closely over the months ahead. So I'd like to conclude by restating the main message that I started with, and that is that the Australian economy has adjusted pretty well to some very large shocks in the global economy over recent years. We've been able to maintain a high degree of internal balance while at the same time accommodating significant change in the structure of our economy. Businesses right across the spectrum are adjusting to these new realities. The adjustment is often difficult, but it does hold out the prospect of higher productivity and higher living standards for us all. Monetary policy has played an important supporting role in this adjustment by keeping inflation low and stable, and the Reserve Bank of Australia is committed to continuing to play that role. Thank you for listening, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Dr. Lowe, Richard Fluke from Shinagawa. Listening to you talk about manufacturing made me wonder whether we're in the same country. From my perspective, I see manufacturing closing, operations, significant redundancies of people, reduced capital investment, turning to importing products rather than manufacturing, reducing of exports. it doesn't seem to me, from my perspective, that a lot of manufacturing, once closed, will ever come back. And I see a major structural change going on, which is, as you say, painful. Yeah. But I don't see that it will lead to higher productivity in the manufacturing sector in the long run, nor do I see it leading to higher living standards in the long run. Would you like to comment?
Well, as I said, this process of adjustment is very painful. There are businesses who are closing and production is moving offshore in some cases. But there are success stories as well. I think in the medium term, Australia cannot, or it's unlikely that we can be a producer of relatively standardised, mass-produced goods. We are likely to have a relatively high cost structure because we have a relatively high exchange rate, and that means that we have to focus on areas where we have strategic and comparative advantages, either because of the spin-offs from other industries, the mining industry, or that we have a human capital or technology advantage. And there are parts of the manufacturing sector that do have that and that are doing quite well. So there's a, within, I think it's not, I don't think of manufacturing as a homogeneous industry. It's a very disparate industry with very different technologies being used, very different levels of human capital across firms. And you see the firms that have good technology, that have good people, that have good management, they are doing, they are finding a place in the world, and I'm confident that they continue to do that. But there are parts of the industry that will continue to adjust in the way that you outlined, and I understand that's very difficult.
Thank you, Philip. That graph on savings and spending patterns was interesting. I mean, the savings ratio. Yeah. You also indicated, though, you thought there was some uptick occurring in spending, household spending. That doesn't necessarily flow through to traditional spending patterns. Can you just sort of outline how you think those spending patterns are changing within households, and then how that then flows through to the broader economy?
Yeah. Well, there are two parts of the changes that are going on. One is the kind of a longer term structural change. We had really from the early 1990s, you can see in this graph, up until the middle of last decade, where households effectively spent every single dollar of income they earned. And as a result of that, the saving ratio came down, and lots of parts of the economy got adjusted to that. The retailers got adjusted to very strong growth in household consumption faster than income. It had spin-offs from the housing market as well. And that period of adjustment took a decade, but it was a period of adjustment, and now that's over. And we've returned to what I consider more normal conditions, with consumption growing broadly in line with income. And I think that's part of one of the difficult adjustments that's going on, that we've moved from a period of very strong growth because of various structural changes in or going on in the economy to now more normal. And that's very difficult for some businesses who thought that maybe that previous trend could continue. So that's the longer-term structural change. There's also a change going on with the type of goods and services that people want to buy. There's been increased demand for a whole range of services relative to goods, and I think that's going to continue. You see it in every developed and developing economy. And so the retail spending is now only a third, or a bit less than a third, of total consumption. So the rest of that is services, and that part's going to grow. The other dynamic that's clearly at work is the greater price transparency that's come about from the internet, and the tendency for people to purchase goods offshore. And that is transforming the Australian retail sector, because they're having to respond to that. So there are a lot of cross currents going on. But my sense is that retail spending is a bit stronger now than it was in the second part of last year, and that's what we would expect from an easing of monetary policy, and it seems to be occurring.
Dr. Lowe, it's Kai Chow from the Financial Review. I just wanted to look at a cross-current overseas instead. I just wondered what your take is on the European situation post the Cyprus situation. Is it something that you think is just a wobble or a correction, or do you think that a lot of the fears about the euro bailout situation perhaps not being as satisfactory as it could be actually have some basis?
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a very interesting question. For quite a long time now, we've been describing the European situation as two steps forward, one step back. I think that remains a reasonable characterisation, and what we've seen in the last couple of days is a step back. I would have to say I was very, very surprised at the announcements earlier this week. The idea that you would go and effectively haircut small depositors to help a government fiscal situation was not something that had really been countenanced by the international community before. I think the aspect of it that is most surprising is that many of these deposits are in fact insured deposits, and at least in the public's mind, there is a risk that this undermines the strength or the belief that people have in the integrity of the deposits. Now, in Cyprus, that may well happen, and it doesn't lead to any particular broader implications. The issue that it does raise, I think, and this is quite a serious one, is in future, if there's banking difficulties in one country, the fact that this approach of haircutting depositors has been sanctioned could lead the public to think, well, it could happen again. And in fact, it could make the system more susceptible to bank runs. And that's something that the authorities in Europe will have to watch very, very carefully.
I have one, Dr. Lowe, which is just on the Australian dollar coming down with the terms of trade. What are the other influences that are keeping it high at the moment, and where do we see it going from here?
My best forecast is always the current exchange rate. I think that's the only exchange rate, only forecast one can give, really. So the terms of trade are clearly the main factor that has driven the Australian dollar higher. But the quantitative easing in the North Atlantic economies is having an effect. I think that's undeniable. These countries are greatly expanding the size of the central bank balance sheets, and the holders of those extra deposits in the North Atlantic are looking for assets elsewhere around the world. And one of the places they find assets to buy is in Australia. And that pushes up the value of our currency relative to theirs. So that's clearly a dynamic that's at work, and I don't expect that to go away anytime soon. The point that we have mentioned many times, and I mentioned it again today, we've taken account of that in our setting of monetary policy. So what we're ending up with is a combination of quite a high exchange rate and quite low interest rates. And you might, in a perfect world, wish for a different combination, but given the developments that are occurring in the global economy, that's not open to us. As I said, we at the Reserve Bank are trying to deal as best we can with the hand that the global economy has dealt us here.
Just on the change in the mining cycle, yep, that's occurred sort of since the middle of last year, since about July, and the change in sort of the investment cycle in the resources sector. How do you see that playing out over the next sort of 6 to 12 months, and then its broader impact on our sort of economic settings and pressures? And we've seen sort of a decline, if not a collapse, in corporate tax revenue over the past year or two, and part of that is resources-based. But how do you see all of that sort of changing cycle playing out in terms of the structural change to the economy?
Yeah. Well, the level of mining investment's close to its peak, and it's going to plateau for a while and then gradually come down. That's our current forecast. Of course, as that mining investment plateaus and then peaks, exports are likely to pick up very, very strongly, and so that will generate substantial income for the country as a whole and should help at the margin, the fiscal situation as well. So we're moving past the investment stage into the production or export stage, and that's going to be to Australia's considerable advantage. In terms of the components of domestic demand, we are seeing the signs, as Harley talked about, a gradual pickup in dwelling construction, and I think all the fundamentals for that are now in place. Non-residential construction has been soft, but there are some signs that that is starting to turn around. There are parts of the industry that are looking a little bit better. The lower interest rates and the low borrowing rates for corporates and the fact that the exchange rate means the price of capital goods is very cheap at the moment, that combined with a gradual pickup in consumer spending, we hope, we expect, will be enough to get businesses to invest a bit more. And as I said in my remarks, this is, I think, the central question. Will the pickup in dwelling construction and business investment be sufficient to offset the plateauing of mining investment and then its gradual decline? At the moment, we see the preconditions in place for that to occur, but it's something we'll be watching very carefully.